I want to thank and introduce a fantastic author and, to be honest, a good friend. That doesn't affect my opinion of this because this book is so profound, but Grady Smith, welcome to the Raucous Caucus.
Thank you, Terry.
It is a pleasure to have you here. And, you know, I wouldn't have normally even introduced this topic, guys, because, you know, we kid around, we carry on with some stuff, but occasionally we have some real serious conversations. And when I read Blood Chit, a novel by Grady Smith, I can't tell you how it affected me. I would call it as close to a definitive book about, one, Vietnam, two, what happens to soldiers in combat, three, what happens to soldiers after combat, and four, what we do and don't do to help soldiers after combat. I use the word definitive advisedly, but I would call this book definitive. And to introduce it a little bit, I want to—I just want to read a little blurb that I offered as part of a review of the book. And this is my honest and sincere feeling. This is again "Blood Chit" by Grady Smith. This is my commentary or review of it. There is more war reality, horror, poetry, pain, and wisdom in Grady Smith's "Blood Chit" than in most libraries. Blood Chit is great. It is also essential, absolutely essential. To trot in the boots of a soldier in Vietnam, if that soldier is Smith's Staff Sergeant Chuck Paxton, in combat in Vietnam, and then never at home while home in Missouri, is to tread in hell. It takes courage to read Blood Chit because it is gut-level honest and real on every page. It is profoundly and painfully obvious that Smith, the author, as a veteran Vietnam commander, knows intimately whereof he speaks. From page one, Smith's and the character Paxton's journey is transfixing and unforgettable as he leads us into the jargon-dividing life in the military, into the graphic, horrid complexity of combat. With equal courage and clarity, Smith then leads us to the devastating, never-ending war of memory, memory within a soldier's forever wounded heart and mind. With literary skill, poetry, wisdom, and terror, he dares us to see what we do to our soldiers or anybody's soldiers. If ever a president, a congressperson, an editor, a pastor, a citizen, a talk show host, if any of them are ever tempted to support the unleashing of the dogs of war, it's more than likely that they haven't had the guts to read the tragic reality of Blood Chit. I trembled, I winced, until I wept. I will never forget this book by Grady Smith, Blood Chit. I know that's a heavy intro, guys. And but it is important because
Garland's crying now, Terry. I want to thank you. He's sitting here. He's just sobbing his eyes out. Way to go.
Not yet.
Yeah, that's it. But that's normal. I mean, I'm generally crying, 15 minutes into the show.
Yeah, right. We haven't broken that. But Grady, welcome to the Raucous Caucus.
Thank you. I appreciate you guys putting me on.
Yeah, and just give us a little background to begin with of what led you to write this incredible book and why you feel it's so darn important today.
I was in Vietnam in 1968. I had an infantry company in the Delta. I put 20 years in the Army, and while I was, I refer to that as the OD womb. It was kind of a place of warmth and support for me until about 1985. And then the experiences began to catch up with me, and I started journaling about this.
Your personal experiences.
That's correct. And then someplace along the lines, I realized that I could control the outcome, even if I tweaked the facts of my own experience, if I made this a work of fiction. And so that's when I made the big shift and started writing Blood Chit as a novel.
And you say twist the facts, but that's, or tweak the facts, but that's just your personal facts. The facts.
That's correct. Yeah. As usual, fiction is when it's done reasonably well, is lying in order to communicate the truth.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Because, I mean, and everything that you report in the book is accurate, correct, as what that can happen and does happen to many soldiers, and particularly soldiers in Vietnam.
Absolutely. And not just those guys. I think I'm using Sergeant Chuck Paxton and his Vietnam experience as a springboard to jump into even the current Afghan war. As you know, Terry, having read the book, suicide of veterans is a one of the major themes of the book, and we've got that going on right now. It's right out of the newspaper headlines that we see. Last June, The Post and The New York Times both reported that year-to-date military suicides exceeded combat deaths in Afghanistan.
Hey, well, Grady, Garland Nixon here, and a quick question, not to interrupt you, but, you know, we hear that, you know, people, you know, the average citizen reads, okay, there were X amount of suicides in the military, et cetera, and they don't really understand it. You've been involved with it. You've been with other soldiers. You've been in the heat of war. Can you tell people who wouldn't have any idea, why do you think it is that so many soldiers commit suicide, based on your experience?
Yeah, that was a question I asked myself for a long time and didn't come up with any answers on until a shrink by the name of Jonathan Shea wrote a book called Achilles in Vietnam. He worked for 20 years with veterans at the Boston VA hospital, and he laid down a paradigm. And the paradigm is this: when you're in combat, you see the crushing and the destruction of moral compass, and you see friends, often close friends, killed or maimed or wounded. And it's the accumulation of those experiences that result in the wounding of a veteran's psyche. That's where it comes from. The violation of what's right in a moral sense and the seeing of the death of comrades.
Grady, this is Mark Levine. I have a friend who's a veteran, and I know that he's a veteran of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. He was actually a medic, so I guess, I don't know, it sounds like he saw more than his share of horror, because he had to go
Absolutely.
In and save lives and shoot his way in, sometimes shoot his way out. Anyway, to this day, he will wake up in the middle of the night, basically sit up straight in bed screaming. I'd like to ask you in general about post-traumatic stress injury.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't have it. I haven't been – I'm not a veteran. I very much value, you know, that so many people are fighting and dying, sometimes for wars I don't believe in, but I never take it on the veterans, because all of them are very brave, courageous people. I'd like for you, if you could, to describe to me, to Terry, to Garland, to our listeners, what it's like. What is PTSI like? How do you feel it coming on? How does it manifest itself? Are you reliving what happened? Give for me just what it feels like to have an attack of PTSI.
An attack, yes. There's an atmosphere that results from PTSD, a kind of pervasive numbness that won't go away. But when you have a so-called attack of it, this manifests in a couple of different ways. You can have a flashback while you're walking and talking, and in the company of people, you can have a flashback to specific events that you experienced while you were in combat. Sometimes this flashback waits until you're asleep, and your subconscious doesn't have to stay under the iron discipline of your conscious self, and it can come out in dreams, and that's what your friend is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
A buddy of mine who was a Marine platoon leader in Vietnam just 2 or 3 years ago, 40 years after the fact, came down with a 103-degree fever, and he sat up in bed, and he said, "They're in the wire. The gooks are in the wire." It was the whole complex of his experiences that seeped up out of his subconscious.
But does it feel violent? I mean, is it like you hear a loud noise and you immediately duck, duck, and cover?
You get a startle response from loud noises. I remember I came back from Vietnam. I was driving down one evening the firing range road at Fort Benning, and all of a sudden, as I was going underneath this berm, about 10 machine guns opened up on the other side of that berm. There were no rounds going overhead, but the instant noise of combat just about put me in the ditch. I had all I could do to keep control of the vehicle.
There's a scene in the book, and I was trying to find it so I could read it, and maybe you could find it in a little bit, Grady, but there's a scene that particularly struck me when the character is simply, as I recall it, simply mowing the lawn. And
yes.
Something goes wrong with the lawnmower. It hits something or something like that, and it stops, or anyway, it makes a loud noise and all that. And the way Grady Smith has written it is so brilliant. It's literally one sentence in the present dealing with the lawnmower and that crisis. And then immediately the next sentence in the same paragraph is back. He's back in Vietnam, and everything is in terms of Vietnam. Then it's right back again, another sentence in the present, then right back into Vietnam, just continuing that pattern of not knowing where reality is, and it's absolutely terrifying. Is it that loss of not of reality, of which reality you're in, that becomes so dangerous?
It can be, yeah, and that's a fairly extreme example of it. Here he is cutting the grass. And at the same time, he's thinking back to when he was on security at a fire base one night, and they were suddenly attacked by a battalion of North Vietnamese. And as he's deep in that memory, pushing that lawnmower, it goes over the top of some object. He gets hit in the chest with a piece of secondary shrapnel, something picked up. And he looks down, and he's got blood on his stomach. He had his shirt off while he was cutting the grass. And he loses it. He falls down on the ground, and he starts yelling for a medic. And he's home cutting his grandmother's lawn.
It's scary. And, you know, nothing that scared me, which I think is so important in the book, I mean, the combat itself, and I really want to stress, too, again, I mean, the writing is absolutely brilliant. And part of the brilliance in the combat descriptions is the incredible detail that Grady Smith gives to it, often in the military jargon. And is that jargon, I mean, it's kind of a strange question, but your book brings up so many thoughts, Grady. Is the jargon of the military, is it something that actually removes the soldier even further from the reality of what he's involved in?
In a way, yes. It objectifies, it professionalizes, it hopefully moves the individual soldier away from an emotional response to what's going on so that he can very rationally and calmly kill the bad guys. Another thing that helps that, you remember I just talked about my friend who woke up in a 103-degree fever and said the gooks are in the wire. Gook is one of those terms, used to be Japs, it used to be Nazis. It's one of those terms that dehumanizes the bad guys and in some degree makes it easier to kill them.
Question, Grady. You know, one of the issues in our society is that people, Americans, you know, we've got a certain segment here, a very large segment, that's very pro-war, people who haven't fought in wars that are pro-war, and that seem to talk about war like they're talking about the football game on Saturday.
By tons of computer games and fight wars on it as if it were reality.
You know, how does that make you feel, or what would you say to people when, you know, we've had callers, you know, and if you deal with the talk radio, you're going to hear some from callers or different people who talk about, you know, we should go get these guys, you know, and it's always we when they're going to sit home and somebody else is going to go get shot to pieces, but it's a we, you know, collective as though they're part of it when all they're doing is sitting back like they say, we beat the Cowboys last week, you know?
Yeah. No, my reaction, guys, get a life.
Yeah.
You do not comprehend the reality of what it's like out there to hunt human beings and be hunted in your turn.
Speaking of callers, we're going to give you an opportunity to call in and talk with Grady Smith and ask any question you want at 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. This is the Raucous Caucus, WPFW 89.3 FM. We usually get to callers after the break, so it'll be after the half hour, but if you want to go ahead and dial in, you're welcome to do so. Grady, I want to ask the flip side of Garland's question. And that is not the pro-war people, but the anti-war people. I was not around in the Vietnam era, but I definitely heard it said that that there was a feeling among veterans that many people worked hard. People like Terry worked very hard marching, trying to end the war in Vietnam. And a number of veterans came home, and the anti-war crowd and the veterans, at least at that era, didn't really know how to deal with each other. The veterans were suffering from post-traumatic stress. I call it post-traumatic stress injury. It used to be called post-traumatic stress disorder. They're both sure. accurate. But so the veterans were feeling very unappreciated for what they did. And the left at that time, the anti-war left, some of them, I think it's fair to say, were so against the war for absolutely good reasons that they couldn't appreciate the veterans. My question for you is, do you think that current Iraq and Afghani veterans are more appreciated, even though, I mean, I was against the war in Iraq, but I still can appreciate the sacrifice of the veterans. Are anti-war crowds and veterans getting along better now?
Yes, in brief. But I think my generation in Vietnam had to go through that period where you didn't know if you went downtown in your uniform if you were going to be called a baby killer or not. We had reached a point in the larger society where we were not yet able to distinguish the war from the soldiers fighting the war. Retrospectively, we got a handle on that. And right now, there are a lot of people out there who think we should not be in Afghanistan, at least not
I don't think we should be there anymore.
We are, but they will not throw the baby out with the bathwater. They respect the troops for what they're going through and what they're experiencing. That's different from my generation.
Let me ask you a question in terms of that, Grady, because it gets to kind of a thing. Because I am, you know, of your generation, and I was, you know, very much opposed to the war. And,
yes.
Even before much of the movement started, I started to publish articles, et cetera, opposing the war. And I felt... And I don't know I'm not sure that there's a right or wrong answer to this, but I would like, because I respect you so much, your reflection on it. Back then, you know, the draft existed.
Sure.
And I firmly believe in national service. I always
Amen to
have.
That.
But even with the draft, it is a choice that a soldier goes in to combat, in the sense he can claim, and I know it was even more difficult back then, he can claim conscientious objection, etc.
Yes.
You know, at what point, it's just really hard for me to understand, I guess, what I'm trying to say, Grady. At what point do we say it is a soldier's choice to get put in that situation, and therefore there is a moral accountability? And I know
in the context of the draft, Terry, it was very difficult for a young man to decline to go unless he was ready to go to Canada or do some other extreme kind of action taking
or unless
to
he
get
was,
out from under the burden.
I have to say, or unless he was Bush and Cheney and had friends in high places.
Yeah, if he was very wealthy, yeah. He was extremely wealthy.
Oh, don't take me there. I'll eat up the rest of the program.
I just wanted to be clear. There were people who could buy their way out, but they were not middle-class people.
As with so many other things in our society, you know, the truly horrific things that we face in our society, the very, very wealthy don't have to worry about that. And again, that's a reason, one of the other reasons that the Bush and the Cheneys and the people who were born with the silver spoons in their mouths are so quick to rush us to war, because it's a game to them.
But yeah, one of the dangers I see for the Republic is the shrinking number of veterans in the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How do we get past this, this conundrum, though? I mean, on one hand, you know, we say, okay, we want you to be a soldier, we want you to protect the country, we want you to be brave and courageous, and we want you to go do horrendous things in the service of being brave and courageous.
Yes.
And at the same time, of course, we recognize war crimes, and you've gone too far.
I think the only long-term way to deal with it, Terry, is what you suggested, national service. And by that, I don't mean necessarily military service.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I just mean we need to point out by making the current younger generation take specific action to give back to a larger entity than themselves, through the Peace Corps, perhaps, through some domestic action of helping out on farms. It can be as simple as that. But there needs to be a sense of responsibility to something larger than the individual self.
And there, Grady and I are in total agreement. I mean, national service, I think, is essential for a variety of reasons. One, crossing some class lines that divide us so much. And two, the simple idea that, you know, as a citizen, you must serve, period.
Well, and, you know, there's something else that could come from there. If there was some form of national service, and because there are a lot of people, for whatever, for religious reasons, who wouldn't want to be involved in the military, they could do other things, you know, build levees or help the poor, whatever the case. But another very positive thing that could come of that is that, as a result, people could get, you know, college funds, people could get, you know, health care, things like that. As, you know, after you do this national service, other benefits that would help our society could be added along with that.
Absolutely.
Grady, Terry has praised your book for being very blunt and honest and dark. And I
which pretty much sounds like Terry most of the time. Blunt, honest, and dark.
Hey,
no wonder he likes it, for God's sake.
They don't call me the father of optimism for no reason.
Right.
Well, but I wanted to ask you, I was going to go pretty dark there. Now, my question is, I assume, Grady, you had to kill people, and I guess I've never been in that situation. I hope to never be in that situation.
Amen.
But how does that feel? I mean, I guess you shoot so that you're not shot at. Do you just take your mind out of it? Does it become like a video game, and then you think about it later? How does that feel?
The training takes over. You don't have time to stop and think. You have to act instinctively. When it's over and you have a moment to think about, criminy, I've killed human beings, then you fall back to the paradigm that hopefully we followed, that we do it out of duty and not out of
vengeance,
brutality, or savagery. But you see, the process of accumulating enough horrible experiences during a combat tour leads inevitably down that PTSD path, and as you go down that path, you get farther from a sense of duty to justify your actions, and you get closer to that savagery. And in extremis, what you wind up with is a soldier who is a berserker.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me say this, Grady, because
we need to take our break.
You're right.
Guys, we're coming up on a break here. We're talking to Grady Smith, again, the author of this incredible book called Blood Chit, C-H-I-T. I want to make sure I have people understand that on the air. And we should explain what a blood chit is, and when we get back, also, I want to talk, Grady, a little bit about what happens to the dead soldier, which is really shocking to me, and I did not know that, and I hope the same things aren't happening today. Well, we'll get back to all of that on the Raucous Caucus. This is the Raucous Caucus.
Let's give out the phone number.
89.3 FM Pacifica, and we will be back with you and your phone calls in a minute.
202-588-0893.
The WPFW Local Station Board, in partnership with the NAACP Alexandria Chapter, presents a town hall meeting. Please join us on Monday, August 20th, between 6:30 and 8:30 p.m. at the Charles Houston Rec Center. The Charles Houston Rec Center is located at 901 White Street in Alexandria, Virginia. This is an opportunity for WPFW listeners and others in the WPFW signal area to dialogue with WPFW management, staff, and board about issues affecting our community. The Charles Houston Rec Center is located just two blocks from the Braddock Metro Station. WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital.
Into the night and back to the Raucous Caucus.
Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus.
Back to the Raucous Caucus. I am Terry DiCastro with my colleagues
Garland Nixon
and Mark Levine,
and with our very special guest in a very profound show that we are doing with a profound book based on a profound book called Blood Chit by Grady Smith. And Grady, a couple things. We're going to be opening the phone lines here, 202-588-0893.
We've already got callers.
Ah, goody. But the first question, I've got two questions before we get to the phone lines. One, what exactly is the blood chit?
Okay, a chit is an IOU. You know, if you've played poker late into the night, you may wind up leaving an IOU, a chit, in the pot. A blood chit is the term that American pilots in combat use for a message they carry around. In World War II, you know, you remember the Flying Tigers with their leather flying jackets, and they had this thing sewn on the back. It's a nationalist Chinese flag and some Chinese characters. Basically, what that says is, and I'm looking at a translation here, this foreign person has come to China to help in the war effort. Soldiers and civilians, one and all, should rescue, protect, and provide him with medical care. In other words, a blood chit is, take care of me, and I owe you for my life.
Mm-hmm. And the soldiers and various soldiers carried this with them?
That's correct. In the Vietnam era, the message was a little bit longer, and it ended with, my government will reward you if you get me back to it. But basically, that's the message. What they carry around is one of the indestructible artificial materials with printing on it in 17 languages, as I recall, back in Vietnam. About as wide as a handkerchief, about half again as long. The top third is an American flag. And then there follows 17 different languages of the same message. This
wow.
guy has had misfortune. He needs your help. Take care of him. Feed him. Give him medical care. Take him back to his people, and his government, the United States government, will reward you.
And the second question, Grady.
Well, the question is, though, would they actually reward? Would they actually pay the
absolutely.
People?
Absolutely.
So people honored the blood chits to
absolutely.
Get the reward?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There were people, even in Korea, who took care of American pilots who were downed during the early year part of that combat, and who at great risk took care of them and got them back to American lines. One Korean gentleman was captured by his own soldiers after the pass-off of the American, and he was tortured and killed.
Mm, wow.
So, yes, years later, when all the facts came out, he was paid by the federal government, and that money went to his son. He was given a financial reward for what he had gone through. He gave up his life.
Wow.
Grady, the other question I just wanted to get in briefly before we get into our callers is simply, you talked about what happens to a dead soldier and what happens to their body, or what happened to it, at least in Vietnam. And I know it's incredibly graphic, it's certainly something that I had never heard of in all my study, reading, watching films, everything else. I've never heard of this whole process. Can you briefly enlighten us as to that process of what was done to the dead soldier in Vietnam?
Oh, the one who was killed? Yeah. The KIAs, the men who were killed in action, are taken to what's called a graves registration point. Their bodies there are prepared, they're cleaned, they're embalmed, and they are put into shipping cases for the trip back to Dover, Delaware. In the Vietnam War, there was also a West Coast portal, which duplicated what goes on even today at Dover, Delaware. And it gets kind of graphic. I had to do research at the National Archives, and then I finally found a guy who was in graves registration in Vietnam, and he told me how it was in there. And you're absolutely right. It's extremely graphic. Sometimes those bodies come in and, well, it's not a pleasant deal.
Let me go to the phone lines at 202-588-0893. Matt, welcome to the Raucous Caucus.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, Matt.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you fine. What's your comment?
Yeah, I'd like to point this question at Grady and Terry. I wanted to know because I was not 18 when they ended the draft, and I think it's important for the younger half of our generation. And for me, and as well as X and Y, I'd like to hear about what it was living around the draft at that time and living in that kind of society where you didn't know what your future was going to be.
Great question. Thank you for your call.
That is a great question. And, you know, since I was not taken into combat or not taken into the military, and merely by I belonged to one of the largest draft boards in the country, so the odds were not that high that I would be called up. And then I got married and had an exemption after that with a child, et cetera. So it kept me out by these exemptions, which they kept on changing the exemptions. So basically the whole thing is, whether you were at war in Vietnam or whether you were here in the United States opposing it, it was incredibly high anxiety because nobody knew what their future was next. And the war kept on escalating, and the reporting of the war was much more honest than it is today. And we saw what was happening and what Grady writes about. And the sense of anxiety, making plans for schooling, for education, for marriage, for children, anything else, was just you didn't want to make those decisions because you didn't know what was next, and you had friends who were getting drafted and friends who were getting killed and friends who were running to Canada. And you had riots in the street, and you get beaten up by the cops. So it was ugly over here, and it was sure as hell ugly over in Vietnam. Very high anxiety.
Grady, how did you feel when your number was called?
I volunteered.
Oh, okay. tell us why.
There's a kind of a tradition in the family. I've got a great-great-grandfather under a Confederate Army headstone back in Rockingham County, North Carolina. My dad was in World War One. My uncle was in World War Two. His son, my cousin, was in Korea. Jim Webb talks about the same phenomenon, the senator from
Virginia
who was in the Marines in Vietnam. There's that same tradition in his family.
In hindsight, would you have volunteered? If you knew then what you know now?
Oh boy. Boy, is that a good question. Let me think about
all
that
right.
And get back to you.
All right. You can say you don't know. No, I like to ask the tough questions. Let's go back to the phone lines.
Let me just give one little brief response here to that because it kind of exemplifies the situation. My younger brother was in the Navy and during Vietnam. And I wound up in graduate school while he was in the Navy in Vietnam. And he came to visit when he had a leave. And we were in one of our local pubs. And, of course, we got in an argument. And he came close to killing me in the argument over that because I was opposing the war that he was fighting in. And obviously since then we have repaired the relationship completely. But at that time, it was hell.
202-588-0893. Let's go to Harold. Harold, welcome to the Raucous Caucus.
Hey, Raucous Caucus. Thanks a lot. I listen to you guys a lot and enjoy you tremendously.
Yeah, we're sorry to be so somber today. We usually are joking around a lot more, but it is a serious topic. Go ahead.
Totally. Grady Smith, welcome home, brother.
Thank you, sir.
I'm a Vietnam veteran as well.
Cool.
I can't say that I will read your book. I'm not able to look at war movies or read war stuff.
Yeah, I don't do war movies myself yet. I'm not ready.
Yeah, I'm just not there yet. But I was drafted actually. After the riots that followed Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination.
Yes.
The urban areas were pretty much swept clean. I think the thinking was, if you Negroes want to fight, we got one for you.
Yep.
And so I was caught up in that. Initially, when the first couple letters actually came, I didn't even open them. I just sent them back return address. And I had a couple of white friends who were making their way to Canada. I initially was going to join them, but my father, who was a World War II veteran, was extremely disturbed about this. I have an uncle sure. who's also a veteran. I had a brother who was in the Air Force. So anyway, I ended up going getting drafted into the Army. After I got in, I ended up becoming an RA or a regular. I re-enlisted
sure.
so that I could go to jump school, 101st Airborne. But I just want to ask. One question was asked that you know that people would ask me that would make me so angry. How does it feel to kill? And it wasn't until recently I just re-entered the VA system because I'm having nightmares again. I thought all the stuff was behind me. And I want to answer that question in particular. The nightmare I'm having in particular is the face of my first kill. To me, it was a target at the time of the incident. I wanted to see my work. So when we went out for the body count, I looked at this kid. He couldn't have been no more than 15 years old. I was 18.
Yeah.
In that instant, our positions transposed. It was like he was looking at me. His eyes were looking right at me. I cannot get this kid's face out of my head, and he's haunting me. It's something I thought I'd put way behind me.
Yes.
Things that trigger it, like this shooting out here in Aurora, stuff like that.
Sure.
Those kind of things trigger, you know, brings back all these memories. And how does it feel to kill? It is the worst. That's the only confirmed kill I'm aware of. I never wanted to see anyone else that I shot because I was a pretty good shot. I was a marksman, sharpshooter. Incidentally, I was in the quartermaster corps. Someone asked, at some point, can the soldier be held accountable for not refusing to go into combat? Well, I was a quartermaster. That's supply.
Sure.
I didn't think I would ever see combat. But there's one thing that was pointed out to me was that my primary MOS was 11 Bravo T.
That's infantry. That's a ground pounder. You qualify.
Which is infantry for those of you who don't know. And I was put in a lot of situations that it basically comes down to pure survival. I was there during a time of racism. Sometimes I would go back to my I was stationed at my base camp was in LZ,
yeah.
The landing zone. It's a little larger. For those of you who don't know, it's a little larger than a base camp, but it's not that large. Sometimes going back in, I didn't know whether I was in Vietnam or if I was refighting the Civil War.
The racism was that strong.
So many Civil War flags would be flying above, and it was tolerated.
Harold, thank you very much for calling in, for sharing your very powerful story. I really do appreciate it.
I would urge Harold to pursue the Veterans Administration window for PTSD. There's no time limit on that. If you've got your DD-214, which is that one-page summary of everywhere you were sent and what awards you got, if you've got that, take that in and you may very well qualify for disability with PTSD.
And that's,
it's
that
out
call,
there. You've earned it, believe me. Go
yeah,
for
that
it.
Call, that call is so important that we just received.
It really was, I agree.
Very powerful.
Because, I mean, he is saying, you know, here we are 50-some-odd years later, and he is having the dreams now.
Grady, I wonder if you could comment on racism during the Vietnam War among the troops. Was it open? Was it among some, most? Were whites and blacks kind of separated? I know not formally, but tell me what racism existed in the American military in the Vietnam era, in your experience.
It started with the draft. Blacks usually came from the poverty end of urban America, and they were the least likely to be able to get out from under that draft threat. In addition, there was a program which took young men whose IQs were slightly below average by, 10 or 15 points, lower than usual. And the educational system at the time did not train black young men in a way that would allow them to be measured accurately, and so they got the short end of that stick as well. Then they got to put a uniform on and go over there. The separation of the races was varied from unit to unit. It depended upon the attitudes that principally that the white guys brought in. But I have to tell you that there were some attitudes among troops who were black concerning their white buddies. One black guy told me what his daddy advised him. He said, if you have to kiss a white guy or a snake, pick the snake. So it was a racial divide that cut both ways.
It's hard to
and
fight a
from
war
my
when
point of view, even as a lowly
themselves.
Company commander, what that did was reduce the efficiency of the fighting
of
force.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah, and let me.
That's
and
the impact on it that's important from my point of view.
That's very important because what you're saying there is that the very social ills that we deal with in our country, they transfer themselves to the military. They transfer themselves to an institution such
and
as that.
Absolutely, particularly in the Vietnam War when the end strength force was so large, what you have is society in miniature. And that includes all of the prejudices, all of the attitudes, all of the crud that is unresolved out there in civilian clothes is still unresolved in the military. It's just that the external military discipline can put that in abeyance for a while you get on with the business of killing other human beings.
Let's get to the next caller. It is K.O. I hope I'm pronouncing that name right. K.O., welcome to the Raucous Caucus.
How you doing? Yeah, K.O. You know, I was in the Marine Corps, and I remember two friends of mine. One was a Mexican-American guy, and another one was a young lady, African-American, from Mississippi.
Yeah.
They wanted to get married on base. And they wanted the military wedding. You know, we get the dress blues and put the swords up. But the chaplain told them, I don't believe in interracial marriages. So Delgado told them, say, man, I ain't white. I'm Mexican. He said, I don't care what you say. You look white to me, and I ain't doing it. That's just one story. But look at here.
Wow.
As far as the question of why so many soldiers committing suicide, I'm going to say this. My opinion, you ain't seen nothing yet. And the reason, I heard one reason was given. My personal opinion is this. The closest thing that soldiers get to see or can compare to people over in Afghanistan and Iraq is, I would say, Amish people in this country. And that's who they over there shooting and killing. And the people is innocent. Because we'd kill a million already in Iraq, and they ain't did nothing to us, had nothing to do with 9/11. So I think the real reason the suicide is when a soldier realized that what they've been doing is all based on lies.
Yes.
Every war this country's been in was based on lies and deception.
I couldn't agree more. You're right.
Corporations running the whole show.
And that brings out a point I'd like to bring up. Yeah, thank you very much, Cale. Great calls tonight. And that is the issue, you know, and it happened in Iraq, and we saw it from people in this country. And basically, the dynamic works like this. A war starts that you feel is unjust and unreasonable and should not happen. However, after the war starts, you have to jump on board and support everything and support the war because, you know, that mentality that says, well, it is America. Once the war starts, no matter how unjust, you're supposed to jump on board and support everything about it. And the soldiers are supposed to say, hooray, you know, we're happy to be doing this. That kind of, and once again, I think that goes back to that kind of almost sports mentality.
Yeah, that there's an older tradition than that, too, that supports that. My country, right or wrong?
Right.
You know, but that doesn't cut it. My country, right or wrong, until I change the party in power.
Right.
Grady, let me ask you, Grady. I mean, because one of the things that we're obviously seeing with this, you know, discussion and interview, and again, we're talking to Grady Smith in his new book, Blood Chit, C-H-I-T. Grady, have we made any progress at all? Is the military, is our society really understanding what we ask soldiers to do and dealing with it appropriately?
No. I'll start with a no, and then we can go to Grady.
Okay. Grady?
Okay, so no, our civilian folks do not clearly understand what we ask of our soldiers. Killing in that context is an abstraction. It's not mm-hmm. blood. It's not the bodies that get taken into the graves registration point. The civilians have a vague John Wayne-y impression of what goes on there. Maybe that's too old. Maybe something like
Rambo.
Hurt Locker, from what I hear about that. It's a very realistic film, and it shows some GIs who have emotional hurts. But then the audience, the civilians, leave and go home, and the next morning they have their coffee and they read the sports page.
Mm-hmm.
Is the military doing any better in dealing with the soldiers and with PTSD?
The military in the last 2 to 5 years has been working its tush off to help these guys to locate men and women in uniform who are at risk, not just from the deleterious effects of PTSD, but who may actually take their own lives. And as hard as they've been working, Time magazine 3 weeks ago had an article on its cover called One a Day, and they mm-hmm. were referring to military suicide.
202-588-0893. Let's go to Jim. Jim, welcome to the Raucous Caucus.
Uh-oh.
Hello?
Jim?
Jim?
Yep.
I think you got your radio on. Turn it down because there's a delay.
Okay.
And then talk to us.
Okay, I'm calling. I'm a little concerned that you guys are promoting imperialist wars and justifying them.
Promoting?
I served 2 years in federal prison for resisting the draft and resisting the war in Vietnam. There mm-hmm. are alternatives to war.
Yes.
I don't think we're promoting them.
No,
I think we're talking about the horrors of war. I don't think we're promoting them.
Let me respond to that. The reason that I wanted to have this show featuring Grady Smith and Blood Chit, and mm-hmm. I hope our caller follows through with this, the reason is because this book is so damn honest, it is painful. This book is real, it is honest, it is personal, it is definitive in what happens to the soldier in combat, to what happens to their minds, what happens to their hearts, what happens to their families, what happens to their soul, and it's all part of what our country denies and hides from. I am totally anti-wars. Everybody that's ever listened to me knows. And, you know, there are wars that are necessary, not justified. Necessary, but not justified.
But are you still there, Jim?
Totally against war. And this people need to read this book to understand what the hell it is we're asking people, our brothers and sisters and sons and fathers, what we're asking them to do. Because it's wrong what we ask them to do. And the book shows it beautifully and honestly with wisdom and compassion.
Well, it's interesting that Jim, saw it that way because, I'm confused as to how someone could listen to this show, but, you know, everybody has their own perspective.
No, look, I mean, I don't judge Grady for fighting and I don't judge Jim for not fighting. I think it's very brave, frankly, all three, and I'm not of your generation. But I think Grady's decision to fight, Jim's decision to go to jail, and Terry's decision to fight the war in mm-hmm. the streets were all three brave decisions. And I can judge the policymakers who got us into Vietnam up and down, and I do, but I don't judge the choices of the young men.
And far be it for me to judge the poor choices of a person who's 18, 19, 20 years old, because God knows the choices I made back then, I certainly wouldn't want to be judged for them now.
The way the Vietnam War was set up politically forced young men of draft age to make moral choices. And my morality is not Terry's morality
right.
in that context. He took one fork in the road, and I took another.
Yep.
But we drank a lot of coffee together. Or at least we did while Terry was still in town here.
All right, let's go to our last caller, RG. Welcome to the Raucous Caucus.
Hey, guys.
Hey,
great
there.
Show. Just realized we only have a couple of minutes left, but came from a military family where I saw some of that PTSD to a lesser extent. Certainly wasn't known as such. We're talking the late 60s, early 70s among my older stepbrother, who was a Marine in Vietnam. But it doesn't necessarily qualify to have to be PTSD to be a veteran or to be a soldier of war. I think PTSD exists in mental disorders that border on that pathologically. Exists,
one second.
On the violence we've had in recent weeks.
Let me just say this real quick, RG. I like the fact they've changed the name from post-traumatic stress disorder to post-traumatic stress injury, because disorder makes it sound like it's the veteran's fault. And God
right.
knows it's not the veteran's fault. So I don't consider it a disorder. It's an injury. But go ahead.
Yeah. You could be a soldier or you could be a civilian citizen. I think that the clinical pathology of the disease or the injury, like you said, doesn't just end and begin with the battlefield. That there are people walking the streets who've had traumatic experiences and things that have happened,
absolutely,
which may manifest itself medically and clinically in the same way. Could your guest speak to that, or if one of you guys have a weigh in on it?
Go ahead, Grady.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Combat is only one source of traumatic stress. It can be rape. It can be political prisoners being tortured. It can be being an inmate at Abu Ghraib. It can be
a hurricane victim, like a Katrina victim.
Absolutely. New Orleans. Check it out. So, yes, I couldn't agree more. There's all kinds of ways to get traumatic stress.
Grady, I've got one final question. I know we're running out of time here, but you know what? Today we're taking the soldier further and further away from the war. Not all soldiers, obviously, but I mean, with the drones and everything else, we're pulling ourselves back and further from the reality of it, and therefore there's going to be less human suffering on our part, even while we inflict suffering. What is going to happen morally as we turn it over to the machines?
Oh, okay. This past weekend was my regimental reunion. The guys I fought in Vietnam with got together. There's still a battalion of that regiment active duty, 31st Infantry Regiment at Fort Drum, New York. They are going to deploy in January for their sixth tour since 9/11. And
tour?
While the number of people who have to go over there continues to diminish, there are still Americans who have to go over there and hunt human beings.
We only have about a minute.
Now, how is it going to work? I don't know. My experience is Vietnam, and that didn't work worth a damn. And I'm fearful that that may be what's going to repeat itself, but I don't know.
Wow.
We're running out of time, just enough time to thank our guest, Grady Smith, the author of Blood Chit. This is Mark Levine with
Garland Nixon
and
Terry DeKessler, Seeking Our Truth and Beauty on the Road.
We're going to be in studio the rest of this month, every Tuesday at 7 p.m., the Raucous Caucus, and then come September back at Ben's Next Door. We hope that you join us then. For now, this is Mark Garland and Terry signing off.